Good morning. I'm Allison Ruttenberg, appearing on behalf of Mr. Charles Medicine Blanket. I am here pro bono. I did represent Mr. Medicine Blanket. I was appointed by the ADC when he did his original 35C. And at that time, I noticed that there were certain glaring errors that my predecessor in the court below didn't notice. And, you know, really felt like that they needed to be addressed with a subsequent 35C. And volunteered to represent Mr. Medicine Blanket pro bono in an effort to try to straighten it out. And that's also why I asked for oral argument here today, because I just feel that changing his sentence and increasing it by tacking on the additional 5 years probation when he was not originally sentenced to that, even though he could have been, is just so fundamentally unfair that it needs to be addressed and corrected.
If I could start there, counsel. By the way, I commend you for your taking this on pro bono. But as I read the statute, the trial court was not supposed to say how much discretionary parole to give to Mr. Medicine Blanket under the statute. But it's required that he get discretionary parole under the Section 17. 2201-5A, as I read the statute.
Well, certainly when he's up for parole, I mean, he's not going to spend every day of his sentence in the DOC.
And there's case law that says that it doesn't add anything if discretionary parole can't add to the length of a sentence. So I'm having trouble grasping your argument that this was somehow unfair to him to put discretionary parole on it.
It was unfair to resentence him to mandatory parole. It was illegal and unfair, and I think the Attorney General agrees with that. And then
right, and you got rid of that, right?
Right.
Okay. Although it still appears on the minimus, which has to be fixed, right?
Right. But the district court's order was we'll just change the word mandatory to discretionary so that he's going to receive at least 5 years of parole, and he still objects to that.
Okay, but if it doesn't add to his sentence, which the case law and the statute indicate, and if we were to send it back and tell the trial court to take off any term of discretionary parole, isn't there no harm, no foul? At least under the case law, it seems to indicate that's the case.
Well, but he's still, and I've had other clients in this situation who were determinately sentenced sex offenders who fall into this kind of narrow exception. If for some reason he ends up spending every day of his sentence in the DOC, which I think is unlikely, but it's possible, then he has to be unconditionally released on his release date. He cannot be released on parole.
That's right. I mean, and I was going to ask the same question Judge Terry did. So here, I mean, he originally got 55 years, as I recall. Now he's got 41.
Right.
And he cannot, under a discretionary parole regime, spend one day on parole more than that 41 years. He's got to be done at 41, as I understand discretionary parole, as opposed to if it was 5 years mandatory, it would be 41 plus 5. So here, there's no way he does more than the term than 41 years. How is that an increase of his sentence?
Well, I mean, my contention is the whole reference to parole has to be taken off the minimus. The parole board, under the statute, has the discretion to parole him sooner than 41 years and set the terms and conditions of parole. But that doesn't appear on the minimus, and it's got nothing to do with his sentence. That's a separate statute under which the parole board has discretion to parole these determinately sentenced sex offenders who fall under this Cooper Martin exception.
Maybe I'm not tracking with you and Judge Terry. It sounds like you're saying the same thing, that the judge shouldn't have set any term for discretionary parole. You're saying he should be on discretionary parole, and it's up to the parole board to decide.
Exactly. All of that language needs to be removed from the minimus, and then it's up to the parole board. I mean, the way Judge Facing left it after the second 35C is that he was going to enter a new minimus that said, you know, 41 years total plus discretionary parole, which I think is
5 years. Did he state 5 years?
Well, his new sentence now is 41 years, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right.
So Judge Royce talking about the parole. I think he did set a term of the discretionary parole.
A term on the discretionary parole, which also has to go, presumably.
Exactly, yes. And that's what I'm asking this court to do. Just The reference to parole needs to be removed from the minimus, and certainly the parole board under the statute has discretion to parole him sooner. But if for some reason he stays in the Department of Corrections for 41 years, then he has to be unconditionally released.
Is there some harm to just having the minimus corrected to say he can get discretionary parole and not say anything about a term?
To me, that would be confusing. I've got a case currently in Boulder right now where we've got this confusion with another sex offender who's kind of in the same position.
If you make a reference to the statute, then it's pretty clear to the DOC what they have to do, isn't it?
Well, it would be my preference that it would be removed altogether, because that's not part of the sentence of the court. That is a separate statute under which the parole board has discretion to parole him. But I suppose if it were worded in that manner, then there would be no harm, no foul, because then it would be clear that it's up to the discretion of the parole board when he gets paroled, and they set the terms and conditions and the length and whatever, so long as he's unconditionally released once he serves 41 years.
In your experience, Ms. Rettenberg, and Mr. First can address this as well, is the general practice here not to reference discretionary parole at all? Is that the most common practice, or is it one way or the other?
Well, you know, we don't have too many of these discretionarily sentenced sex offenders anymore who fall in this group. But my experience is there is no reference to parole on the minimus.
I think that was the classic practice when discretionary parole was, in fact, the parole system.
Right.
And I don't mean to detain you. I know you have a lot of other things to address.
No, I know. So, that was the main reason, main thing I wanted to address. But I do also wanted to address the district court's order that he wasn't even going to consider the Silva Rule 35C on the merits, because he said, well, he doesn't get to come back and relitigate double jeopardy issues. That's not what he's trying to do. He's trying to...
We understand that, counsel.
Exactly. And I think that nothing else can happen then except a remand to the district court with instructions to consider that Silva issue on its merits and decide whether it's appropriate then to appoint counsel and hold an evidentiary hearing. Because I think I have stated, you know, especially with respect to the double jeopardy issues, that there was a serious oversight made by trial defense counsel that then my predecessor post-conviction counsel also missed. And there's too many disputed issues of fact there to be able to determine on this record whether that has enough merit to go forward or not. We need to have an evidentiary hearing.
Could you, your time is of course limited, would you address the issues we've asked you to be prepared to address an argument, whether Trujillo, the standard for ineffective assistance of appellate counsel should be extended to post-conviction counsel?
I'm not.
Did you not see this? Maybe. That would be frightening if you didn't see an order.
The order I received from the court after a lot of back and forth over email was just the order of March 27th setting this argument. Am I missing something?
Well, maybe see one, and that would be concerning. I think we sent out an order. Mr. First,
my copy of counsel.
What's the date?
March 30th.
What we asked.
Can we stop the clock for a moment to let counsel?
I'm having a terrible problem with my post office. They have a bunch of trainees. And what happens is when the Court of Appeals, I've asked them not to do this, but they still do it, they put a case number in the mailing envelope, and then the automatic sorting system, like this is case number 1946, that will go into post office box 1946 instead of my post office box. And then so I'm getting mail 2 or 3 weeks late because of that. And I apologize, but it looks like it's happened again, because the last thing I got on March 31st was the notice of oral argument. So
we'll apologize to you as well, Ms. Rettenberg. So the issue at least we raised there, I'll see.
Let's give her a chance to read the order. Pardon me, Judge.
Well, my answer is going to be no. It's the strict Washington standard, and if I can show a prima facie case on both prongs, I should at least get an evidentiary hearing.
why don't we go, I suppose we can go back on the time. So, the, I mean, obviously the issue we're raising, yes, it's the same standard as Strickland, but Trujillo and cases like it say when you're talking about appellate counsel, the Strickland kind of test requires us to look at, did appellate counsel fail to raise an issue that was stronger than the ones appellate counsel raised? I mean, it seems like I fully understand your argument that about why you get a shot at post-conviction counsel being ineffective, given where we are. But why it seems to me like their post-conviction counsel is at least an analogous position to appellate counsel. And the question, you know, that we were trying to raise, and I'm sorry you didn't see, was should the same standard apply? Do we, when we look at ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel, should we say, or look at the question as to whether these issues are better than the ones post-conviction counsel did raise?
Well, if post-conviction counsel at the evidentiary hearing can take the stand and say, I considered that and rejected it because I didn't think it was going to go anywhere, then that gets you to the same place, that you wouldn't meet your burden of proof on the first prong of Strickland. I mean, the major difference between appellate counsel and post-conviction counsel is in the appellate arena, we've got very strict page limits that are almost never expanded. And appellate counsel has to make very serious determinations as to what issues to raise within the page limits, because there is not an unlimited amount of space to raise every single potential issue. But in a post-conviction arena, especially in a serious case like this, where it's likely that this person is going to die in prison, he needs to raise every compelling constitutional issue. Otherwise, it's ineffective assistance to do so. And in a procedural posture where we're at right now, it's impossible without an evidentiary hearing to even make a determination as to how strong this issue is until we remand back to the district court and be able to get post-conviction counsel on the stand and see, well, why did she reject that issue? Was she even aware of it? I've got a very strong suspicion that she's going to testify that she simply overlooked it.
Let me ask you about that, Ms. Ruttenberg. So, I mean, there are two issues. I think there's a speedy trial issue and a double jeopardy issue.
Right.
On speedy, applying the usual standards that we have, Artolino and the like, I mean, on the face of the complaint, you certainly say, he was around, what took him so long? But there are a couple of issues that are at least of some concern here. I mean, he didn't raise the issue for 13 years after he got it. There's no allegation as to when the police knew where he was. I recognize you say they could have found him and maybe arguing negligence on their part, you know, but just applying the normal 35C Artolino kind of standards, you know, why are the allegations sufficient here to allow us to say you get a hearing when we don't know that the police, you know, when they knew? That would be different if we knew they knew on this date and waited 2 years.
First of all, I'll concede that the speedy trial issues are weaker than I think that double jeopardy issue is. And to be perfectly candid, if I didn't have those double jeopardy issues, I would not have also raised the speedy trial issues, but I didn't want to be in the same position I'm accusing Ms. Baker of being in and not additionally raising this issue. But your concern about why wasn't this raised sooner, I think, is a perfect example of why maybe trial counsel was ineffective, that the fact that it took 2 years for the defendant to be arrested after he was charged raises a prima facie case that he should have at least investigated. And now we're all in these layers of speculation as what did he know and when did he know it, and what should he discovered sooner, and therefore what should a post-conviction counsel done and that she didn't do. And this is all reasons why I don't think this panel can unravel all these issues, and there has to be a remand.
Oh, I'll throw you a lifeline here and let you say the double jeopardy issues are stronger. I mean, I have some concerns with those as well. I mean, big issue is lesser included offense, and I think we all now agree it's not a lesser included offense. Have at it. Why do the double jeopardy issues are sufficiently alleged to get a hearing?
Well, again, there's a big hole in the facts here that has to be litigated before the district court, and that is, were there two distinct assaults, or were there four? I mean, I again concede that there's a possibility that there were four distinct assaults, and if there were, then these consecutive sentences are not unconstitutional. But I think that the way the record is right now, and I tried to brief it as carefully as possible, that it certainly raises a very serious issue, that there were only two assaults charged two different ways, and that everybody kind of got, you know, these head blinders on of thinking, well, okay, there's four separate convictions of crimes of violence, so we have to sentence consecutively. And Mr. Silver, at the sentencing hearing, was on the right track, but then he dropped the ball and forgot to follow up on it.
So, Rettenberg, let me just make sure I understand exactly what your argument is on this. Is it your argument that charge 5 and charge 9 are the same assault, and then separately charge 6 and charge 10 are the same assault as each other, but not necessarily the same assault as 5 and 9?
Exactly.
Okay. All right. I was having trouble following that, and that's the best I could make. Okay.
All right. But there might have been four separate assaults, but the way Mr. Silver left the record and failing to ask for certain instructions, we can't determine that.
Why don't we, doesn't that create just a mere possibility that the jury relied on identical evidence? I'm trying to figure out what, you can't call the jurors to ask them, and so, you know, what evidence would we see here that's going to establish this wasn't just a mere possibility of identical evidence?
Well, because I think it's the other way around. I think there's only a mere possibility that it was the same, and the flip side, that it's the stronger, that it's much more likely that it was two assaults and not four, and there's just a mere possibility that there was only four, and it's the government that's kind of arguing, well, since there's this possibility that there were four, then you don't need to go any further with this.
But what evidence would you put on at a hearing to decide whether it was one, two, or four?
Well, first of all, we need to hear from Mr. Silver as to what his thought processes were, what his notes were, to see really whether he dropped the ball or whether he was aware that there was evidence of four. I think that from the transcripts that there was clearly only evidence of two, charged two different ways.
Well, I compliment your answer to the question you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I thought that was a pretty good answer.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm out of time now.
Rettenberg, can I just tell you, I think the court was initially surprised, and your opposing counsel were surprised to learn that you had requested oral argument, because the request for oral argument was in a document that was titled Reply Brief.
I apologize, and I've got this really bad habit of using old pleadings as templates and not.
Okay, well, you may want to get rid of that.
Yes.
Thank you.
May it please the court, John First for the people. I guess my answer won't be quite as succinct on the court's question. I want to thank the court sincerely for giving us the question ahead of argument. That's a big help. It saves me, you know, 10 days. It's way better than 10 seconds to try to answer a question like this. I think the standard's adaptable. Obviously, the contexts there is some similarity, but some fundamental differences as well between direct appeal and post-conviction. I was prepared to walk in here and agree with the opposing counsel that no, but I'm not so sure that no is the right answer, and I say that because I reread Rule 35, CRIMP 35, and specifically 35C3, Roman numeral 5, because it talks about if the trial court refers what's typically a pro se motion to the public defender. And the public defender has some duties. And one of those duties, and prefaced by the word shall, and it was, don't often have to litigate that particular part of the rule, so it was sadly news to me. But it says shall, among other things, add, and this is public defender, shall add any claims the public defender finds to have arguable merit. And that's a bit disconcerting to me, but that's in the rule. But it suggests the scope of counsel's duty. And on direct appeal, I think it's clear that the scope of direct appellate counsel's duty is to essentially scour the record. Anders v. California talks about conscientious examination of the case, and I think that's appropriate. In other words, direct appeals counsel, direct appellate counsel, has started a clean slate, I think, in terms of looking at the case. Then it, and then
appellate counsel or 35C
counsel? No, I'm talking about appellate counsel, because the standard you're, the court's asking about comes from
yes.
The standard from direct appeals counsel, so I'm trying to less than succinctly relate the two. But I think it's important because, again, I think the scope of direct appeal counsel's duties is effectively to scour the record and then, as the Supreme Court has said, to raise your strongest issues. Here's your clearly stronger. And clearly, that's where that standard clearly strongest issue standard comes from. But then when you get to post-conviction counsel, what's the scope of counsel's duty? And that's why I say I was prepared to say no, because in thinking about this, I wasn't sure initially that the scope of post-conviction counsel's duties was to scour the record. Because initially, you're not starting with a clean slate. You're starting with that motion, albeit pro se. Nonetheless, you're starting with that motion. And you know, until I found this language in 35C that I just read, it seems as though counsel is not starting with a clean slate, and it's the scope of counsel's post-conviction counsel's duty may be just to effectively prosecute those claims that were in the pro se motion. But 35C says no. No, I mean, the public defender shall, if it gets the motion, the court finds that the defendant's not entitled to relief on the face of the motion in the record, and sends it over to the PD. At that point, the public defender shall add any claims the public defender finds to have arguable merit. I mean, getting a little closer to scouring the record. I'm not sure what fines means, if in the course of preparing the claims that that are raised in the motion, counsel happens to say, oh, here's a good claim, arguable, colorable claim, we better assert that. If that were the situation, I think counsel would be deficient. If it didn't raise counsel, he or she didn't raise a claim that he finds to have arguable merit. But they're still, in my mind, even under this language, fines to have arguable merit, question whether or not, how far they have to go, the public defender or appointed counsel, ADC, has to go to find those claims. I don't know.
And is the issue perhaps, Mr. First, this is a policy question here, what the rule is trying to get at is raise them all now because you can. There are successiveness issues and all the like. Is that your sense of what the why that's there?
And that may be part of what they had in mind. I don't know. But I think also going into this mix, since we're talking about ineffectiveness, I mean, that's a great point. And I think that probably is part of it. Yes. Since we're talking about the Strickland standard for ineffectiveness, once counsel is appointed, even though it's a statutory procedure, I mean, the court has said, and our Supreme Court has said in several that once it's appointed, Strickland's the standard. We were kind of going along with that before, I think.
We're under Hickey.
That's what I mean. I mean, they just kind of confirmed Hickey.
Mr. First, I can get you to turn.
Is that when we're talking about ineffectiveness, we're talking about the prevailing standards of practice. So, I mean, and that would be prevailing standards of post-conviction practice for post-conviction counsel. And so, I suppose it's, if the court's going to apply that standard, then there has to be allegations and findings on what The prevailing practice is for post-conviction counsel, once they get that motion, do they scour the record? I mean, I don't know, and that's obviously not in the record, so that's all I want to say about that. I'm sorry. Thank you.
Oh, no, not at all. I would give you time limited. I appreciate your addressing Ms. Ruttenberg's arguments here just on the merits. She says with some force that, you know, Mr. Medicine Blanket here at least pled enough to get a hearing both on speedy and on the double jeopardy issue. I mean, on the speedy, I understand your argument. We don't know when they knew, but, I mean, isn't that a question that a reasonable fact finder could say, you know, they should have known? Likewise, on the double jeopardy, it's pretty hard to assess. I mean, I get you can say always it's a possibility of identical evidence, but, you know, how do we know? We're kind of grasping at a straw here. So my question is, why hasn't Mr. Medicine Blanket pled enough? I mean, he made all the right allegations in this 35C. Ms. Ruttenberg was pretty careful.
Well, they don't have, evidence doesn't need to be alleged in the motion. You have to allege sufficient facts, and it's our contention that on all the claims, allegations are conclusory.
Well, what else can she say? I mean, for example, on the double jeopardy issue, she says the same evidence was used to convict the defendant of charges 9 and 10 as 5 and 6. What else does she say? She made the allegation. The same evidence was used. I suppose you could say anything is conclusory, but that's a pretty specific factual statement.
We have the record. We have the record of trial, all the witnesses' testimony, and the instructions, and the verdict forms, and the jury's deliberations question, and the court's answer to that question. I think the court has to look at all of it, and then when you look at all that, all you're left with, at most, favorable to the defendant is a mere possibility, and Jewell says that's not enough. And as to the allegations of speedy trial, I mean, I don't think it's evidence to allege why the police didn't know. I mean, proving it's one thing at an evidentiary hearing. Alleging the facts is why, and she said, and counsel alleged, the passage of time. That's conclusory as to prejudice, and that's critical, if not typically, determinative on the constitutional speedy. And so, I guess it's our position that.
On speeding,
we're
not there. And I understood your argument on the record too. So what you're saying is missing, at least on the allegations. There's no allegation that this particular witness who has multiple sclerosis had lapses in memory, or just a bald allegation of passage of time.
And the record is contrary.
Yeah. Okay.
In fact,
I understand your point.
So again, we're looking at the trial court's looking at this not just at the motion, but I mean, under a rule, must deny the motion if look at the allegations and the record. So the court has that record, and what I don't recall is if I don't recall who conducted the trial, whether post conviction trial, and I suspect probably not. I mean, we're going back to 2001, and I guess my overarching concern. About these kind of claims is it circumvents timeliness, it circumvents excessiveness. I mean, the courts, we've got opinions certainly saying that failing to raise a claim when you had the opportunity in a prior proceeding.
How could they have alleged, and I'll again be candid with you, Mr. Rose, I have a lot of trouble with the finding that the ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel claim was successive. How could they have raised that one before?
Well, they could have raised, well.
We have other arguments, but why is that successive? It's the first shot to raise it.
Well, in this case, our concern is that with this kind of standard, the counsel three proceedings down the road, oh, post-conviction counsel number four was ineffective for failing to raise a claim, that post-conviction counsel was ineffective, three was ineffective for failing to raise, because post-conviction counsel two was ineffective for failing to raise it. I mean, just,
that's the door I tried to close in Hickey. Yeah. But it didn't work.
No, I hope that you try and judge. You know, I mean, and especially timeliness here. We're talking about a case that mandated in 2001. We're coming in 8 years later. I'm getting a little tired. But, you know, 8 years later to raise this claim, this way that post-conviction counsel one was ineffective for failing to raise a claim, that trial counsel and appellate counsel were ineffective for failing to raise another claim. Where does it stop? I mean, and you know, when you're talking about the standard clearly stronger, I think clearly you have to, obviously there have to be allegations of fact as to the strongest claim. And they had a strong claim. They had a claim that prevailed in the previous post-conviction proceeding, and that was the double jeopardy claim as it affected the position of trust counts. Pretty strong to me. I mean, they prevailed on that claim. You're not going to get any stronger. And I think that part of the mix also has to be, you know, I was a little facetious as to all the iterations, but I think that has to go into it. I mean, if you're going to say that post-conviction counsel was post-conviction counsel was ineffective for failing to allege that appellate counsel and trial counsel were ineffective for failing to raise claims, I think that clearly stronger has to work its way back to all those other allegations, so that you have to look at what claims were that appellate counsel, you know, were the strongest. And if trial counsel missed a claim, trial counsel also has to, that analysis has to, I mean, I'm not sure how it plays out, but I think those are the considerations that the court
needs. It turns out that we keep having these meetings.
Yeah. Unless the court has any other questions, I just ask to affirm the order.
Thank you, counsel.
May I make a statement?
Sure.
Just a point of information. The Attorney General's office has asked us as a court to give advance notice to counsel prior to an oral argument as to what issues the panel may want to have addressed during oral argument. And so there may be, this may be the coming thing, that there will be an advance of oral argument or orders going out similar to this one. So somehow you should be looking for those.
But there will not be additional issues. There'll be just the ones in the briefs. We thank both counsel for their arguments and briefs. The case will be deemed submitted, and I may now freely announce the court will be in recess.